We would have to have help from Lee, if only the help of a listener to clear his own thinking. Cal had led his brother outside and conducted him to the wagon shed where the tall Ford rested. Cal opened the door and sat behind the wheel. "Come on, get in," he said. Aaron protested. "Father told us to stay out of it. He won't ever know. Get in." Aaron climbed in timidly and eased back in the seat. Cal turned the wheel from side to side. "Honk, honk," he said. And then, "You know what I think? I think Uncle Charles was rich." "He was not. I bet you anything he was. You think our father'd tell a lie?" "I won't say that. I just bet he was rich." They were silent for a while. Cal steered wildly around imaginary curves. He said, "I bet you can find out."
"How do you mean? What you got to bet?"
"Nothing," said Aaron.
"How about your deer's leg whistle? I bet you this here taw against that deer's leg whistle that we get sent to bed right after supper. Is it a bet?"
"I guess so," Aaron said vaguely.
"I don't see why," Cal said. "Father will want to talk to Lee, and I'm going to listen."
"You won't dare."
"You think I won't? Suppose I was to tell?"
Cal's eyes turned cold and his face darkened. He leaned so close that his voice dropped to a whisper.
"You won't tell, because if you do, I'll tell who stole his knife."
"Nobody stole his knife. He's got his knife. He opened the letter with it."
Cal smiled bleakly.
"I mean tomorrow," he said.
And Aaron saw what he meant and knew he couldn't tell. He couldn't do anything about it. Cal was perfectly safe. Cal saw the confusion and helplessness on Aaron's face and felt his power, and it made him glad. He could outthink and outplan his brother. He was beginning to think he could do the same thing to his father. With Lee, Cal's tricks didn't work, for Lee's bland mind moved effortlessly ahead of him and was always there waiting, understanding, and at the last moment cautioning quietly, "Don't do it." Cal had respect for Lee and a little fear of him. But Aaron here, looking helplessly at him, was a lump of soft mud in his hands. Cal suddenly felt a deep love for his brother and an impulse to protect him in his weakness. He put his arm around Aaron. Aaron didn't flinch or respond. He drew back a little to see Cal's face. Cal said, "See any green grass growing out of my head?" Aaron said, "I don't know why you go for to do it."
"How do you mean? Do what?"
"All the tricky, sneaky things," said Aaron.
"What do you mean, sneaky?"
"Well, about the rabbit and sneaking here in the car. And you did something to Abra. I don't know what, but it was you made her throw the box away."
"Oh," said Cal, "wouldn't you like to know?"
But he was uneasy.
Aaron said slowly, "I wouldn't want to know that. I'd like to know why you do it. You're always at something. I just wonder why you do it. I wonder what it's good for."
A pain pierced Cal's heart. His planning suddenly seemed mean and dirty to him. He knew that his brother had found him out, and he felt a longing for Aaron to love him. He felt lost and hungry, and he didn't know what to do. Aaron opened the door of the Ford and climbed down and walked out of the wagon shed. For a few moments, Cal twisted the steering wheel and tried to imagine he was racing down the road. But it wasn't any good, and soon he followed Aaron back toward the house. When supper was finished and Lee had washed the dishes, Adam said, "I think you boys had better go to bed. It's been a big day." Aaron looked quickly at Cal and slowly took his deer's leg whistle out of his pocket. Cal said,
"I don't want it."
Aaron said,
"It's yours now."
"Well, I don't want it. I won't have it."
Aaron laid the bone whistle on the table.
"It'll be here for you," he said.
Adam broke in.
"Say, what is this argument? I said you boys should go to bed."
Cal put on his little boy face.
"Why?" he asked.
It's too early to go to bed.
Adam said, That wasn't quite the truth, I told you. I want to talk privately to Lee. And it's getting dark, so you can't go outside, so I want you boys to go to bed. At least to your room. Do you understand? Both boys said, Yes, sir. And they followed Lee down the hall to their bedroom at the back of the house. In their nightgowns, they returned to say goodnight to their father. Lee came back to the living room and closed the door to the hall. He picked up the deer's leg whistle and inspected it and laid it down. I wonder what went on there, he said. How do you mean, Lee? Well, some bet was made before supper, and just after supper, Aaron lost the bet and paid off. What were we talking about? All I can remember is telling him to go to bed. Well, maybe it will come out later, said Lee. Seems to me you put too much stock in the affairs of children. It probably didn't mean anything. Yes, it meant something. Then he said, Mr. Trask, do you think the thoughts of people suddenly become important at a given age? Do you have sharper feelings or clearer thoughts now than when you were 10? Do you see as well, hear as well, taste as vitally? Maybe you're right, said Adam. It's one of the great fallacies, it seems to me, said Lee, that time gives much of anything but years and sadness to a man. And memory. Yes, memory. Without that, time would be unarmed against us. What do you want to talk to me about? Adam took the letter from his pocket and put it on the table. I want you to read this, to read it carefully, and then I want to talk about it. Lee took out his half glasses and put them on. He opened the letter under the lamp and read it. Adam asked, Well, is there an opening here for a lawyer? How do you mean? Oh, I see. Are you making a joke? No, said Lee. I wasn't making a joke. In my obscure but courteous Oriental manner, I was indicating to you that I would prefer to know your opinion before I offered mine. Are you speaking sharply to me? Yes, I am, said Lee. I'll lay aside my Oriental manner. I'm getting old and cantankerous. I'm growing impatient. Haven't you heard of all Chinese servants that when they get old, they remain loyal, but they turn mean? I don't want to hurt your feelings. They aren't hurt. You want to talk about this letter? Then talk, and I will know from your talk whether I can offer an honest opinion or whether it is better to reassure you in your own.
I don't understand it, said Adam helplessly.
Well, you knew your brother. If you don't understand it, how can I, who never saw him? Adam got up and opened the hall door and didn't see the shadow that slipped behind it. He went to his room and returned and put a faded brown daguerreotype on the table in front of Lee. That's my brother, Charles, he said. And he went back to the hall door and closed it. Lee studied the shiny metal under the lamp, shifting the picture this way and that to overcome the highlights. It's a long time ago, Adam said, before I went into the army. Lee leaned close to the picture. It's hard to make out, but from his expression, I wouldn't say your brother had much humor.
He hadn't any, said Adam. He never laughed.
Well, that wasn't exactly what I meant. When I read the terms of your brother's will, it struck me that he might have been a man with a particularly brutal sense of play. Did he like you?
I don't know, said Adam. Sometimes I thought he loved me. He tried to kill me once.
Lee said, Yes, that's in his face, both the love and the murder. And the two made a miser of him, and a miser is a frightened man hiding in a fortress of money.
Did he know your wife?
Yes.
Did he love her?
He hated her. Lee sighed. It doesn't really matter. That's not your problem, is it?
No, it isn't.
Would you like to bring the problem out and look at it?
That's what I want.
Go ahead, then.
I can't seem to get my mind to work clearly.
Would you like me to lay out the cards for you? The uninvolved can sometimes do that. That's what I want. Very well, then.
Suddenly, Lee grunted, and a look of astonishment came over his face. He held his round chin in his small, thin hands.
Holy horns, he said. I didn't think of that.
Adam stirred uneasily.
I wish you'd get off the tack you're sitting on, he said irritably. You make me feel like a column of figures on a blackboard.
Lee took a pipe from his pocket, a long, slender ebony stem with a little cup-like brass bowl. He filled the thimble bowl with tobacco so fine-cut it looked like hair, then lighted the pipe, took four long puffs, and let the pipe go out.
Is that opium? Adam demanded.
No, said Lee. It's a cheap brand of Chinese tobacco, and it has an unpleasant taste.
Why do you smoke it, then?
I don't know, said Lee. I guess it reminds me of something. Something I associate with clarity. Not very complicated.
Lee's eyelids half closed.
All right, then. I'm going to try to pull out your thoughts like egg noodles and let them dry in the sun. The woman is still your wife, and she is still alive. Under the letter of the will, she inherits something over $50,000. That is a great deal of money. A sizable chunk of good or of evil could be done with it.
Would your brother, if he knew where she is and what she is doing, want her to have the money?
Courts always try to follow the wishes of the testator.
My brother wouldn't want that, said Adam.
And then he remembered the girls upstairs in the tavern and Charles' periodic visits.
Maybe you'll have to think for your brother, said Lee. What your wife is doing is neither good nor bad. Saints can spring from any soil. Maybe with this money she would do some fine thing. There's no springboard to philanthropy like a bad conscience.
Adam shivered.
She told me what she would do if she had money. It was closer to murder than to charity.
You don't think she should have the money, then?
She said she'd destroy many reputable men in Salinas. She can do it, too.
I see, said Lee. I'm glad I can take a detached view of this. The pants of their reputations must have some thin places. Morally, then, you would be against giving her the money.
Yes.
Well, consider this. She has no name, no background. A whore springs full-blown from the earth. She couldn't very well claim the money, if she knew about it, without your help.
I guess that's so. Yes, I can see that she might not be able to claim it without my help.
Lee took up the pipe and picked out the ash with a little brass pin and filled the bowl again. While he drew in the four slow puffs, his heavy lids raised, and he watched Adam.
It's a very delicate moral problem, he said. With your permission, I shall offer it for the consideration of my honorable relatives, using no names, of course. They will go over it as a boy goes over a dog for ticks. I'm sure they will get some interesting results.
He laid his pipe on the table.
But you don't have any choice, do you?
What do you mean by that? Adam demanded.
Well, do you? Do you know yourself so much less than I do?
I don't know what to do, said Adam. I'll have to give it a lot of thought,
Lee said angrily.
I guess I've been wasting my time. Are you lying to yourself or only to me?
Don't speak to me like that, Adam said.
Why not? I've always disliked deception. Your course is drawn. What you will do is written. Written in every breath you've ever taken. I'll speak any way I want to. I'm crotchety. I feel sand under my skin. I'm looking forward to the ugly smell of old books and the sweet smell of good thinking. Faced with two sets of morals, you'll follow your training. What you call thinking won't change it. The fact that your wife is a whore in Salinas won't change a thing.
Adam got to his feet. His face was angry.
You're insolent, now that you've decided to go away, he cried. I tell you, I haven't made up my mind what to do about the money.
Lee sighed deeply. He pushed his small body erect with his hands against his knees. He walked wearily to the front door and opened it. He turned back and smiled at Adam. "Bullshit," he said amiably, and he went out and closed the door behind him. Cal crept quietly down the dark hall and edged into the room where he and his brother slept. He saw the outline of his brother's head against the pillow on the double bed, but he couldn't see whether Aaron slept. Very gently, he eased himself in on his side and turned slowly and laced his fingers behind his head and stared at the myriads of tiny colored dots that make up darkness. The window shade bellowed slowly in, and then the night wind fell, and the worn shade flapped quietly against the window. A gray, quilted melancholy descended on him. He wished with all his heart that Aaron hadn't walked away from him out of the wagon shed. He wished with all his heart that he hadn't crouched listening at the hall door. He moved his lips in the darkness and made the words silently in his head, and yet he could hear them. "Dear Lord," he said, "let me be like Aaron. Don't make me mean. I don't want to be. If you will let everybody like me, why, I'll give you anything in the world. And if I haven't got it, why, I'll go for to get it. I don't want to be mean. I don't want to be lonely. For Jesus' sake, amen." Slow, warm tears were running down his cheeks. His muscles were tight, and he fought against making any crying sound or sniffle. Aaron whispered from his pillow in the dark, "You're cold. You got a chill." He stretched out his hand to Cal's arm and felt the goosebumps there. He asked softly, "Did Uncle Charles have any money?"
"No,"
said Cal.
"Well, you were out there long enough. What did Father want to talk about?"
Cal lay still, trying to control his breathing.
"Don't you want to tell me?" Aaron asked. "I don't care if you don't tell me." "I'll tell," Cal whispered.
He turned on his side so that his back was toward his brother.
"Father is going to send a wreath to our mother. A great big goddamn wreath of carnations."
Aaron half sat up in bed and asked excitedly,
"He is? How is he going to get it clear there?" "On the train. Don't talk so loud."
Aaron dropped back to a whisper.
"But how's it going to keep fresh?"
"With ice," said Cal. "They're going to pack ice all around it."
Aaron asked,
"Won't it take a lot of ice?"
"A whole hell of a lot of ice," said Cal. "Go to sleep now."
Aaron was silent, and then he said,
"I hope it gets there fresh and nice."
"It will,"
said Cal.
And in his mind, he cried, "Don't let me be mean."
This ends Disc 14. East of Eden, Disc 15.
Chapter 31. Adam brooded around the house all morning, and at noon he went to find Lee, who was spading the dark, composted earth of his vegetable garden and planting his spring vegetables, carrots and beets, turnips, peas and string beans, rutabaga and kale. The rows were straight planted under a tight-stretched string, and the pegs at the row's end carried a seed package to identify the row. On the edge of the garden in a cold frame, the tomato and bell pepper and cabbage sets were nearly ready for transplanting, waiting only for the passing of the frost danger. Adam said,
"I guess I was stupid."
Lee leaned on his spading fork and regarded him quietly.
"When are you going?"
he asked.
"I thought I'd catch the 2:40. Then I can get the 8 o'clock back."
"You could put it in a letter, you know," said Lee.
"I've thought of that. Would you write a letter?"
"No, you're right. I'm the stupid one there. No letters."
"I have to go," said Adam. "I thought in all directions, and always a leash snapped me back."
Lee said, You can be unhonest in many ways, but not in that way. Well, good luck. I'll be interested to see what she says and does. I'll take the rig, said Adam. I'll leave it at the stable in King City. I'm nervous about driving the Ford alone. It was 4:15 when Adam climbed the rickety steps and knocked on the weather-beaten door of Kate's place. A new man opened the door, a square-faced Finn, dressed in shirt and trousers. Red silk armbands held up his full sleeves. He left Adam standing on the porch and in a moment came back and led him to the dining room. It was a large, undecorated room, the walls and woodwork painted white. A long, square table filled the center of the room, and on the white oilcloth cover the places were set, plates, cups, and saucers, and the cups upside down in the saucers. Kate sat at the head of the table with an account book open before her. Her dress was severe. She wore a green eyeshade, and she rolled a yellow pencil restlessly in her fingers. She looked coldly at Adam as he stood in the doorway. "What do you want now?" she asked. The Finn stood behind Adam. Adam didn't reply. He walked to the table and laid the letter in front of her on top of the account book. "What's this?" she asked, and without waiting for a reply, she read the letter quickly. "Go out and close the door," she told the Finn. Adam sat at the table beside her. He pushed the dishes aside to make a place for his hat. When the door was closed, Kate said, "Is this a joke?" "No, you haven't got a joke in you," she considered. "Your brother might be joking. You sure he's dead?" "All I have is the letter," said Adam. "What do you want me to do about it?" Adam shrugged his shoulders. Kate said, "If you want me to sign anything, you're wasting your time." "What do you want?" Adam drew his fingers slowly around his black ribbon hatband. "Why don't you write down the name of the firm and get in touch with them yourself?" "What have you told them about me?" "Nothing," said Adam. "I wrote to Charles and said you were living in another town, nothing more. He was dead when the letter got there. The letter went to the lawyers. It tells about it." "The one who wrote the postscript seems to be a friend of yours. What have you written him?" "I haven't answered the letter yet." "What do you intend to say when you answer it?" "The same thing, that you live in another town." "You can't say we've been divorced. We haven't been." "I don't intend to." "Do you want to know how much it will take to buy me off? I'll take $45,000 in cash."
"No."
"What do you mean, no? You can't bargain."
"I'm not bargaining. You have the letter. You know as much as I do. Do what you want."
"What makes you so cocky?"
"I feel safe."
She peered at him from under the green, transparent eyeshade. Little curls of her hair lay on the bill like vines on a green roof. "Adam, you're a fool. If you had kept your mouth shut, nobody would ever have known I was alive."
"I know that."
"You know it. Did you think I might be afraid to claim the money? You're a damn fool if you thought that."
Adam said patiently, "I don't care what you do."
She smiled cynically at him.
"You don't, huh? Suppose I should tell you that there's a permanent order in the sheriff's office, left there by the old sheriff, that if I ever use your name or admit I'm your wife, I'll get a floater out of the county and out of the state. Does that tempt you?"
"Tempt me to do what?"
"To get me floated and take all the money."
"I brought you the letter," Adam said patiently.
"I want to know why."
Adam said, "I'm not interested in what you think or in what you think of me. Charles left you the money in his will. He didn't put any strings on it. I haven't seen the will, but he wanted you to have the money."
"You're playing a close game with $50,000, she said, "and you're not going to get away with it. I don't know what the trick is, but I'm going to find out."
And then she said,
"What am I thinking about? You're not smart. Who's advising you?"
"No one."
"How about that Chinaman? He's smart."
"He gave me no advice."
Adam was interested in his own complete lack of emotion. He didn't really feel that he was here at all. When he glanced at her, he surprised an emotion on her face he had never seen before. Kate was afraid. She was afraid of him. But why? She controlled her face and whipped the fear from it. "You're just doing it because you're honest, is that it? You're just too sugar sweet to live." "I hadn't thought of it," Adam said. "It's your money, and I'm not a thief. It doesn't matter to me what you think about it." Kate pushed the eye shade back on her head. "You want me to think you're just dropping this money in my lap? Well, I'll find out what you're up to. Don't think I won't take care of myself. Did you think I'd take such stupid bait?" "Where do you get your mail?" he asked patiently. "What's that to you?" "I'll write the lawyers where to get in touch with you." "Don't you do it," she said. She put the letter in the account book and closed the cover. "I'll keep this. I'll get legal advice. Don't think I won't. You can drop the innocence now." "You do that," Adam said. "I want you to have what is yours. Charles willed you the money. It isn't mine." "I'll find the trick. I'll find it." Adam said, "I guess you can't understand it. I don't much care. There's so many things I don't understand. I don't understand how you could shoot me and desert your sons. I don't understand how you or anyone could live like this." He waved his hand to indicate the house. "Who asked you to understand?" Adam stood up and took his hat from the table. "I guess that's all," he said. "Goodbye." He walked toward the door. She called after him. "You're changed, Mr. Mouse. Have you got a woman at last?" Adam stopped and slowly turned, and his eyes were thoughtful. "I hadn't considered before," he said. And he moved toward her until he towered over her, and she had to tilt back her head to look into his face. "I said I didn't understand about you," he said slowly. "Just now it came to me what you don't understand." "What don't I understand, Mr. Mouse?" "You know about the ugliness in people. You showed me the pictures. You use all the sad, weak parts of a man, and God knows he has them." "Everybody," Adam went on, astonished at his own thoughts. "But you, yes, that's right. You don't know about the rest. You don't believe I brought you the letter because I don't want your money. You don't believe I loved you. The men who come to you here with their ugliness, the men in the pictures, you don't believe those men could have goodness and beauty in them. You see only one side, and you think, and more than that, you're sure that's all there is." She cackled at him derisively. "In sticks and stones, what a sweet dreamer is Mr. Mouse. Give me a sermon, Mr. Mouse." "No, I won't, because I seem to know that there's a part of you missing. Some men can't see the color green, but they may never know they can't. I think you're only part of a human. I can't do anything about that, but I wonder whether you ever feel that something invisible is all around you. It'd be horrible if you knew it was there and couldn't see it or feel it. That would be horrible." Kate pushed back her chair and stood up. Her fists were clenched at her sides and hiding in the folds of her skirt. She tried to prevent the shrillness that crept into her voice. "Our mouse is a philosopher," she said. "But our mouse is no better at that than he is at other things. Did you ever hear of hallucinations? If there are things I can't see, don't you think it's possible that they are dreams manufactured in your own sick mind?"
"No, I don't," said Adam. "No, I don't. And I don't think you do either."
He turned and went out and closed the door behind him. Kate sat down and stared at the closed door. She wasn't aware that her fists beat softly on the white oilcloth. But she did know that the square, white door was distorted by tears, and that her body shook with something that felt like rage and also felt like sorrow. When Adam left Kate's place, he had over 2 hours to wait for the train back to King City. On an impulse, he turned off Main Street and walked up Central Avenue to number 130, the high white house of Ernest Steinbeck. It was an immaculate and friendly house, grand enough but not pretentious, and it sat inside its white fence, surrounded by its clipped lawn, and roses and Catonistas lapped against its white walls. Adam walked up the wide veranda steps and rang the bell. Olive came to the door and opened it a little, while Mary and John peeked around the edges of her. Adam took off his hat.
"You don't know me. I'm Adam Trask. Your father was a friend of mine. I thought I'd like to pay my respects to Mrs. Hamilton. She helped me with the twins."
"Why, of course," Olive said, and swung the wide doors open. "We've heard about you. Just a moment. You see, we've made a kind of retreat for Mother."
She knocked on a door off the wide front hall and called, "Mother, there's a friend to see you." She opened the door and showed Adam into the pleasant room where Liza lived.
"You'll have to excuse me," she said to Adam. "Katrina's frying chicken, and I have to watch her. John, Mary, come along. Come along."
Liza seemed smaller than ever. She sat in a wicker rocking chair, and she was old and old. Her dress was a full, wide-skirted black alpaca, and at her throat she wore a pin which spelled Mother in golden script. The pleasant little bed-sitting room was crowded with photographs, bottles of toilet water, lace pin cushions, brushes and combs, and the china and silver bureau knacks of many birthdays and Christmases. On the wall hung a huge tinted photograph of Samuel, which had captured a cold and aloof dignity, a scrubbed and dressed remoteness which didn't belong to him living. There was no twinkle in the picture of him, nor any of his inspective joyousness. The picture hung in a heavy gold frame, and to the consternation of all children, its eyes followed a child about the room. On a wicker table beside Liza was the cage of Polly Parrot. Tom had bought the parrot from a sailor. He was an old bird, reputed to be 50 years old, and he had lived a ribald life and acquired the vigorous speech of a ship's forecastle. Try as she would, Liza couldn't make him substitute psalms for the picturesque vocabulary of his youth. Polly cocked his head sideways, inspecting Adam, and scratched the feathers at the base of his beak with a careful foreclaw.
"Come off it, you bastard," said Polly unemotionally.
Liza frowned at him.
"Polly," she said sternly, "that's not polite." "Bloody bastard," Polly observed.
Liza ignored the vulgarity. She held out her tiny hand.
"Mr. Trask," she said, "I'm glad to see you. Sit down, won't you?"
"I was passing by, and I wanted to offer my condolences."
"We got your flowers."
And she remembered, too, every bouquet after all this time. Adam had sent a fine pillow of everlastings.
"It must be hard to rearrange your life."
Liza's eyes brimmed over, and she snapped her little mouth shut on her weakness.
Adam said, "Maybe I shouldn't bring up your hurt, but I miss him."
Liza turned her head away.
"How is everything down your way?" she asked.
"Good this year. Lots of rainfall. The feed's deep already."
"Tom wrote me," she said. "Button up," said the parrot.
And Liza scowled at him, as she had at her growing children when they were mutinous.
"What brings you up to Salinas, Mr. Trask?" she asked.
"Why, some business."
He sat down in a wicker chair, and it cricked under his weight.
"I'm thinking of moving up here. Thought it might be better for my boys. They get lonely on the ranch."
"We never got lonely on the ranch," she said harshly. "I thought maybe the schools would be better here. My twins could have the advantages. My daughter Olive taught at Peachtree and Plato and the Big Sur."
Her tone made it clear that there were no better schools than those. Adam began to feel a warm admiration for her iron gallantry.
"Well, I was just thinking about it," he said.
"Children raised in the country do better."
It was the law, and she could prove it by her own boys.
Then she centered closely on him.
Are you looking for a house in Salinas?
Well, yes, I guess I am.
Go see my daughter, Desi, she said. Desi wants to move back to the ranch with Tom. She's got a nice little house up the street next to Reynaud's Bakery.
I'll certainly do that, said Adam. I'll go now. I'm glad to see you're doing so well.
Thank you, she said. I'm comfortable.
Adam was moving toward the door when she said,
Mr. Trask, do you ever see my son, Tom?
Well, no, I don't. You see, I haven't been off the ranch.
I wish you would go and see him, she said quickly. I think he's lonely.
She stopped as though horrified at this breaking over.
I will. I surely will. Goodbye, ma'am.
As he closed the door, he heard the parrot say,
Button up, you bloody bastard.
And Liza,
Polly, if you don't watch your language, I'll thrash you.
Adam let himself out of the house and walked up the evening street toward Maine. Next to Renault's French bakery, he saw Desi's house set back in its little garden. The yard was so massed with tall privets that he couldn't see much of the house. A neatly painted sign was screwed to the front gate. It read, Desi Hamilton, Dressmaker. The San Francisco Chop House was on the corner of Main and Central, and its windows were on both streets. Adam went in to get some dinner. Will Hamilton sat at the corner table devouring a rib steak.
Come and sit with me, he called to Adam.
Up on business?
Yes, said Adam. I went to pay a call on your mother.
Will laid down his fork.
I'm just up here for an hour. I didn't go to see her because it gets her excited. And my sister Olive would tear the house down getting a special dinner for me. I just didn't want to disturb them. Besides, I have to go right back. Order a rib steak. They've got good ones.
How is Mother?
She's got great courage, said Adam.
I find I admire her more all the time.
That she has. How she kept her good sense with all of us and with my father, I don't know.
Rib steak medium, said Adam to the waiter.
Potatoes?
No.
Yes, French fried.
Your mother's worried about Tom. Is he all right?
Will cut off the edging of fat from his steak and pushed it to the side of his plate. She's got reason to worry, he said. Something's the matter with Tom. He's moping around like a monument.
I guess he depended on Samuel.
Too much, said Will. Far too much. He can't seem to come out of it. In some ways, Tom is a great big baby.
I'll go and see him. Your mother says Desi's going to move back to the ranch.
Will laid his knife and fork down on the tablecloth and stared at Adam. She can't do it, he said. I won't let her do it.
Why not?
Will covered up.
Well, he said, she's got a nice business here. Makes a good living. It'd be a shame to throw it away.
He picked up his knife and fork, cut off a piece of the fat, and put it in his mouth.
I'm catching the 8 o'clock home, Adam said.
So am I, said Will. He didn't want to talk anymore.
Chapter 32. Desi was the beloved of the family. Molly, the pretty kitten, Olive, the strong-headed, Una with clouds on her head, were all loved, but Desi was the warm beloved. Hers was the twinkle and the laughter, infectious as chickenpox, and hers the gaiety that colored a day and spread to people so that they carried it away with them. I can put it this way. Mrs. Clarence Morrison of 122 Church Street, Salinas, had three children and a husband who ran a dry goods store. On certain mornings at breakfast, Agnes Morrison would say, I'm going to Desi Hamilton's for a fitting after dinner. The children would be glad and would kick their copper toes against the table legs until cautioned. And Mr. Morrison would rub his palms together and go to his store, hoping some drummer would come by that day. And any drummer who did come by was likely to get a good order. Maybe the children and Mr. Morrison would forget why it was a good day with a promise on its tail. Mrs. Morrison would go to the house next to Renault's bakery at 2 o'clock, and she would stay until 4. When she came out, her eyes would be wet with tears, and her nose red and streaming. Walking home, she would dab her nose and wipe her eyes and laugh all over again. Maybe all Dessie had done was to put several black pins in a cushion to make it look like the Baptist minister, and then had the pincushion deliver a short, dry sermon. Maybe she had recounted a meeting with old man Taylor, who bought old houses and moved them to a big vacant lot he owned until he had so many it looked like a dry land Sargasso Sea. Maybe she had read a poem from Chatterbox with gestures. It didn't matter. It was warm funny. It was catching funny. The Morrison children coming home from school would find no aches, no carping, no headache. Their noise wasn't a scandal, nor their dirty faces a care. And when the giggles overcame them, why, their mother was giggling too. Mr. Morrison coming home would tell of the day and get listened to. And he would try to retell the drummer's stories, some of them at least. The supper would be delicious. Omelets never fell, and cakes rose to balloons of lightness. Biscuits fluffed up, and no one could season a stew like Agnes Morrison. After supper, when the children had laughed themselves to sleep, like as not Mr. Morrison would touch Agnes on the shoulder in their old, old signal, and they would go to bed and make love and be very happy. The visit to Dessie might carry its charge into 2 days more before it petered out and the little headaches came back and business was not so good as last year. That's how Dessie was, and that's what she could do. She carried excitement in her arms, just as Samuel had. She was the darling. She was the beloved of the family. Dessie wasn't beautiful. Perhaps she wasn't even pretty. But she had the glow that makes men follow a woman in the hope of reflecting a little of it. You would have thought that in time she would have got over her first love affair and found another love, but she didn't. Come to think of it, none of the Hamiltons, with all their versatility, had any versatility in love. None of them seemed capable of light or changeable love. Dessie didn't simply throw up her hands and give up. It was much worse than that. She went right on doing and being what she was without the glow. People who loved her ached for her, seeing her try, and they got to trying for her. Dessie's friends were good and loyal, but they were human, and humans love to feel good, and they hate to feel bad. In time, the Mrs. Morrisons found unassailable reasons for not going to the little house by the bakery. They weren't disloyal. They didn't want to be sad as much as they wanted to be happy. It is easy to find a logical and virtuous reason for not doing what you don't want to do. Dessie's business began to fall off. And the women who had thought they wanted dresses never realized that what they wanted was happiness. Times were changing, and the ready-made dress was becoming popular. It was no longer a disgrace to wear one. If Mr. Morrison was stocking ready-mades, it was only reasonable that Agnes Morrison should be seen in them. The family was worried about Dessie, but what could you do when she wouldn't admit there was anything wrong with her? She did admit to pains in her side, quite fierce, but they lasted only a little while and came only at intervals. Then Samuel died, and the world shattered like a dish. His sons and daughters and friends groped about among the pieces, trying to put some kind of world together again. Dessie decided to sell her business and go back to the ranch to live with Tom. She hadn't much of any business to sell out. Liza knew about it, and Olive, and Dessie had written to Tom. But Will, sitting scowling at the table in the San Francisco chop house, hadn't been told. Will frothed inwardly, and finally he balled up his napkin and got up. "I forgot something," he said to Adam. "I'll see you on the train." He walked the half block to Dessie's house and went through the high-grown garden and rang Dessie's bell. She was having her dinner alone, and she came to the door with her napkin in her hand. "Why, hello, Will," she said, and put up her pink cheek for him to kiss. "When did you get in town?"
Business, he said. Just here between trains. I want to talk to you. She led him back to her kitchen and dining room combined, a warm little room papered with flowers. Automatically, she poured a cup of coffee and placed it for him and put the sugar bowl and the cream pitcher in front of it.
Have you seen Mother? She asked.
I'm just here over trains, he said gruffly. Desi, is it true you want to go back to the ranch?
I was thinking of it.
I don't want you to go. She smiled uncertainly.
Why not? What's wrong with that? Tom's lonely down there.
You've got a nice business here, he said.
I haven't any business here, she replied. I thought you knew that.
I don't want you to go, he repeated sullenly. Her smile was wistful, and she tried her best to put a little mockery in her manner.
My big brother is masterful. Tell Desi why not.
It's too lonely down there.
It won't be as lonely with the two of us.
Will pulled at his lips angrily. He blurted, Tom's not himself. You shouldn't be alone with him.
Isn't he well? Does he need help?
Will said, I didn't want to tell you. I don't think Tom's ever got over the death.
He's strange.
She smiled affectionately.
Will, you've always thought he was strange. You thought he was strange when he didn't like business.
That was different, but now he's broody. He doesn't talk. He goes walking alone in the hills at night. I went out to see him, and he's been writing poetry. Pages of it over the table.
Didn't you ever write poetry, Will?
I did not.
I have, said Desi. Pages and pages of it all over the table.
I don't want you to go.
Let me decide, she said softly. I've lost something. I want to try to find it again.
You're talking foolish.
She came around the table and put her arms around his neck. Dear brother, she said, please let me decide.
He went angrily out of the house and barely caught his train.
Tom met Desi at the King City station. She saw him out of the train window, scanning every coach for her. He was burnished, his face shaved so close that its darkness had a shine like polished wood. His red mustache was clipped. He wore a new Stetson hat with a flat crown, a tan Norfolk jacket with a belt buckle of mother-of-pearl. His shoes glinted in the noonday light, so that it was sure he had gone over them with his handkerchief just before the train arrived. His hard collar stood up against his strong red neck, and he wore a pale blue knitted tie with a horseshoe tie pin. He tried to conceal his excitement by clasping his rough brown hands in front of him. Desi waved wildly out the window, crying, "Here I am, Tom! Here I am!" though she knew he couldn't hear her over the grinding wheels of the train as the coach slid past him. She climbed down the steps and saw him looking frantically about in the wrong direction. She smiled and walked up behind him. "I beg your pardon, stranger," she said quietly. "Is there a Mr. Tom Hamilton here?"
He spun around and he squealed with pleasure and picked her up in a bear hug and danced her around. He held her off the ground with one arm and spanked her bottom with his free hand. He nuzzled her cheek with his harsh mustache. Then he held her back by the shoulders and looked at her. Both of them threw back their heads and howled with laughter. The station agent leaned out his window and rested his elbows, protected with the black false sleeves, on the sill. He said over his shoulder to the telegrapher, "Those Hamiltons, just look at them." Tom and Desi, fingertips touching, were doing a courtly heel and toe, while he sang doodly-doodly-doo and Desi sang deedly-deedly-dee. And then they embraced again. Tom looked down at her. "Aren't you Desi Hamilton? I seem to remember you, but you've changed. Where are your pigtails?" It took him quite a fumbling time to get her luggage checks, to lose them in his pockets, to find them, and pick up the wrong pieces. At last, he had her baskets piled on the back of the buckboard. The two bay horses pawed the hard ground and threw up their heads so that the shine pole jumped and the double trees squeaked.
The harness was polished, and the horse brasses glittered like gold. There was a red bow tied halfway up the buggy whip, and red ribbons were braided into the horse's manes and tails. Tom helped Desi into the seat and pretended to peek coyly at her ankle. Then he snapped up the check reins and unfastened the leather tie reins from the bits. He unwrapped the lines from the whipstock, and the horses turned so sharply that the wheels screamed against the guard. Tom said, "Would you care to make a tour of King City? It's a lovely town." "No," she said, "I think I remember it." He turned left and headed south and lifted the horses to a fine swinging trot. Desi said, "Where's Will?"
"I don't know," he answered gruffly.
"Did he talk to you?"
"Yes. He said you shouldn't come."
"He told me the same thing," said Desi. "He got George to write to me, too."
"Why shouldn't you come if you want to?" Tom raged. "What's Will got to do with it?"
She touched his arm. "He thinks you're crazy. Says you're writing poetry." Tom's face darkened.
"He must have gone in the house when I wasn't there. What's he want, anyway? He had no right to look at my papers."
"Gently, gently," said Desi. "Will's your brother. Don't forget that."
"How would he like me to go through his papers?"
Tom demanded. "He wouldn't let you," Desi said dryly. "They'd be locked in a safe. Now let's not spoil the day with anger."
"All right," he said. "God knows, all right. But he makes me mad. If I don't want to live his kind of life, I'm crazy, just crazy."
Desi changed the subject, forced the change. "You know, I had quite a time at the last," she said. "Mother wanted to come. Have you ever seen Mother cry, Tom?"
"No, not that I can remember. No, she's not a crier."
"Well, she cried. Not much, but a lot for her. A choke and two sniffles and a wiped nose and polished her glasses and snapped shut like a watch." Tom said,
"Oh, Lord, Desi, it's good to have you back. It's good. Makes me feel I'm well from a sickness."
The horses spanked along the county road.
Tom said, "Adam Trask has bought a Ford. Or maybe I should say Will sold him a Ford."
"I didn't know about the Ford," said Desi. "He's buying my house, giving me a very good price for it." She laughed. "I put a very high price on the house. I was going to come down during negotiations. Mr. Trask accepted the first price. It put me in a fix."
"What did you do, Desi?"
"Well, I had to tell him about the high price and that I had planned to be argued down. He didn't seem to care either way."
Tom said, "Let me beg you never to tell that story to Will. He'd have you locked up."
"But the house wasn't worth what I asked."
"I repeat what I said about Will. What's Adam want with your house?"
"He's going to move there. Wants the twins to go to school in Salinas."
"What'll he do with his ranch?"
"I don't know. He didn't say."
Tom said, "I wonder what would have happened if Father'd got hold of a ranch like that, instead of old Dry and Dusty."
"It isn't such a bad place."
"Fine, for everything except making a living."
Desi said earnestly, "Have you ever known any family that had more fun?"
"No, I don't. But that was the family, not the land."
"Tom, remember when you took Jenny and Belle Williams to the peach tree dance on the sofa?"
"Mother'll never let me forget it." "Say, wouldn't it be good to ask Jenny and Belle down for a visit?"
"They'd come, too," Desi said. "Let's do it."
When they turned off the county road, she said,
"Somehow I remember it differently."
"Drier?"
"I guess that's it. Tom, there's so much grass."
"I'm getting 20 head of stock to eat it."
"You must be rich."
"No. And the good year will break the price of beef. I wonder what Will would do. He's a scarcity man. He told me. He said, always deal in scarcities. Will's smart."
The rutty road hadn't changed, except that the ruts were deeper and the round stones stuck up higher. Desi said, "What's the card on that mesquite bush?"
She picked it off as they drove by, and it said, "Welcome home."
"Tom, you did it."
"I did not. Someone's been here."
Every 50 yards, there was another card, sticking on a bush, or hanging from the branches of a madrone, or tacked to the trunk of a buckeye, and all of them said, "Welcome home." Desi squealed with delight over each one. They topped the rise above the little valley of the old Hamilton place, and Tom pulled up to let her enjoy the view. On the hill across the valley, spelled out in whitewashed stones, were the huge words, "Welcome home, Desi." She put her head against his lapel and laughed and cried at the same time. Tom looked sternly ahead of him.
"Now who could have done that?" he said. "A man can't leave the place anymore."
In the dawn, Desi was awakened by the chill of pain that came to her at intervals. It was a rustle and a threat of pain. It scampered up from her side and across her abdomen, a nibbling pinch, and then a little grab, and then a hard catch, and finally a fierce grip, as though a huge hand had wrenched her. When that relaxed, she felt a soreness like a bruise. It didn't last very long, but while it went on, the outside world was blotted out, and she seemed to be listening to the struggle in her body. When only the soreness remained, she saw how the dawn had come silver to the windows. She smelled the good morning wind rippling the curtains, bringing in the odor of grass and roots and damp earth. After that, sounds joined the parade of perception. Sparrows haggling among themselves. A bawling cow monotonously berating a punching, hungry calf. A blue jay's squawk of false excitement. The sharp warning of a cock quail on guard, and the answering whisper of the hen quail somewhere near in the tall grass. The chicken yard boiled with excitement over an egg, and a big lady, Rhode Island Red, who weighed 4 pounds, hypocritically protested the horror of being lustfully pinned to the ground by a scrawny wreck of a rooster she could have blasted with one blow of her wing. The cooing of pigeons brought memory into the procession. Desi remembered how her father had said, sitting at the head of the table, "I told Rabbit I was going to raise some pigeons, and, do you know, he said, 'No white pigeons.' 'Why not white?' I asked him. And he said, 'They're the rare worst of bad luck. You take a flight of white pigeons, and they'll bring sadness and death. Get gray ones.' 'I like white ones.' 'Get gray ones,' he told me. 'And as the sky covers me, I'll get white ones.'" And Liza said patiently, "Why do you be forever testing, Samuel? Gray ones taste just as good, and they're bigger." "I'll let no flimsy fairy tale push me," Samuel said. And Liza said with her dreadful simplicity, "You're already pushed by your own contentiousness. You are a mule of contention, a very mule."
"Someone's got to do these things," he said sullenly, "else fate would never get nose-thumbed, and mankind would still be clinging to the top branches of a tree." And of course he got white pigeons and waited, truculently, for sadness and death until he'd proved his point. And here were the great-great-grand squabs cooing in the morning and rising to fly like a whirling white scarf around the wagon shed. As Desi remembered, she heard the words, and the house around her grew peopled. Sadness and death, she thought, and death and sadness, and it wrenched in her stomach against the soreness. You just have to wait around long enough, and it will come. She heard the air whooshing into the big bellows in the forge, and the practice tap for range of hammer on anvil. She heard Liza open the oven door, and the thump of a kneaded loaf on the floury board. Then Joe wandered about, looking in unlikely places for his shoes, and at last found them where he had left them under the bed. She heard Molly's sweet, high voice in the kitchen, reading a morning text from the Bible, and Una's full, cold, throaty correction. And Tom had cut Molly's tongue with his pocket knife and died in his heart when he realized his courage. "Oh, dear Tom," she said, and her lips moved. Tom's cowardice was as huge as his courage, as it must be in great men. His violence balanced his tenderness,
and himself was a pitted battlefield of his own forces. He was confused